Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, January 29th. I'm Lauren Schmidt, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Fortuna City Council member resigns amid FBI investigation. Former Willits mayor to fill vacancy on Willits City Council. And the Trump administration rescinds federal grant freeze. But spending review continues. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. We start tonight's broadcast with breaking news, as a Fortuna City Council member has resigned amid an FBI investigation. Fortuna City Council member Chris Mobley has resigned following allegations of theft and embezzlement. KMUD's Lisa Music broke the story and spoke with Fortuna Police Chief Casey Day just before news time.
So the City of Fortuna is aware of an ongoing FBI investigation involving Chris Mobley, a sitting member of the Fortuna City Council. While the city remains committed to transparency, it is important to emphasize that this investigation is being conducted solely under the jurisdiction of the FBI. It is our current understanding that the alleged conduct under investigation pertains solely to Councilmember Mobley's private conduct and does not involve city business. To ensure the investigation remains thorough and impartial, we are not in a position to comment further. We ask for the community's patience and understanding as the FBI continues its work. All inquiries regarding this investigation should be directed to the FBI field office. Any members of the public who have relevant information are encouraged to contact the appropriate authorities through official channels. And for any further inquiries, please contact the FBI's Public Affairs Office.
Chief Day further confirmed that Councilmember Chris Mobley officially submitted her written resignation from the council, effective immediately. He also clarified the allegations she faces.
To our knowledge, the FBI is investigating allegations of theft, embezzlement, but, as I stated, to this point, the alleged conduct that's under investigation pertains solely to her private conduct and does not involve city business or resources.
Although the alleged embezzlement occurred outside of her duties as a council member, KMUD News asked Chief Day whether there will be an investigation into other potential criminal activity that could have impacted the city of Fortuna.
Yes, you know, we've already vetted that to some extent. In this case, there wasn't direct access to city resources. So, you know, the city will cooperate with, the FBI investigation and any asks by the Bureau and, you know, also essentially do everything and anything we need to do to vet that, there was no misconduct that involved city business or city resources.
The Fortuna police chief declined to comment further, but encouraged anyone with information about Councilmember Chris Mobley's criminal activities to contact the FBI's San Francisco field office at area code 415-553-7400. KMUD News will continue to follow this developing story. In other crime-related news, the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office has released information about multiple recent arrests, including two connected to a suspected drug house in McKinleyville. For more details, we spoke with Megan Ruiz, the Public Information Officer with the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office.
Over the weekend, we had two arrested in a McKinleyville search warrant. The Sheriff's Office have received numerous community member complaints regarding criminal activity relating to a residence on the 1500 block of Murray Road in McKinleyville. On January 25th, at about 8:15 a.m., Humboldt County Sheriff's deputies responded to those complaints by executing a search warrant at the problem residence. Upon deputies' arrival at the location, 14 subjects were detained while the house and vehicles were searched pursuant to the warrant. A large amount of drug paraphernalia and multiple firearms were found within the bedrooms and living areas of the residence. Deputies also located an active marijuana cultivation in a garage attached to the residence. The owner, Aaron Stott, age 46, of McKinleyville, was arrested and booked into the Humboldt County Correctional Facility for operating or maintaining a drug house and cultivating six or more plants of marijuana. One of the property's tenants, Dee Shirley, age 71, of McKinleyville, was arrested and booked into the Humboldt County Correctional Facility for being a felon in possession of a firearm, possessing a firearm without identification markings, and possession of unlawful paraphernalia. The Sheriff's Office appreciates the community's help with identifying this location. We encourage community members to call and report criminal activity to the County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251.
Ruiz also provided information about a vehicle pursuit that took place this Wednesday morning south of Eureka.
Today, on January 29th at about 7:45 a.m., a lieutenant with the Sheriff's Office observed two subjects attempting to commit burglary at a residence in Cutton. The lieutenant attempted to contact the individuals who ignored commands, got into their car, and fled the scene. The lieutenant pursued the fleeing vehicle northbound on Walnut Drive into a school zone, where the pursuit was terminated due to public safety of students and residents in the neighborhood. A Be on the Lookout, or BOLO, was advised to law enforcement for the vehicle and the two burglary subjects. About an hour later, a deputy on patrol in Eureka located the vehicle on Broadway, where pursuit was again initiated on the vehicle. The vehicle went southbound on Elk River Road at a high rate of speed and was reported as being seen by a citizen on Berta Road. Deputies located the vehicle and its two occupants on Valley Road, a male adult later identified as Augustus Allen Gibbons, age 20, of Blue Lake, who was confirmed to be on active parole, exited the vehicle and fled on foot into the woods. A female adult, Isabella Lillian Mallon, age 22, of Blue Lake, exited the vehicle and was immediately detained by deputies. A search for Gibbons involved the combined efforts of the Sheriff's Office, the California Highway Patrol, including their aircraft, and a Eureka Police Department canine. Gibbons was located walking along Valley Road in Eureka and arrested for the following charges in addition to his parole-related warrant: attempted burglary, evading a peace officer, two counts, driving without a license, probation violation, and obstructing or resisting a public officer. Anyone with information about this case or related criminal activity is encouraged to call the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251 or the Sheriff's Office Crime Tip Line at 707-268-2539.
You can see photos related to the recent arrests at kmud.org. Turning to Mendocino, the environmental consultant for the Cato Rancheria has concerns about potential impacts to the tribe and non-tribal community members, which will be discussed at a community meeting Thursday evening and live broadcast here on KMUD. KMUD's Kelly Lincoln shares more on what to expect.
Tomorrow night, KMUD's regular public affairs, news, and talk show programming will be interrupted by the live broadcast of the Laytonville Community Meeting, sponsored by the Laytonville Alliance for Environmental Justice and by the Cato Rancheria. The keynote speaker will be Dietrich McGinnis, the environmental consultant for the Cato Rancheria.
The point of this meeting is to really bring to the community just some basic facts about the landfill. How it was operated, what its history is, what is known and documented. There's a lot of rumors. There's probably a lot of folks that saw things that may or may not understand what they were looking at back when it was in operation. So hopefully this can create a baseline that we can all build on. The tribe and the community have this shared problem, and they may be very separate entities, but they both are drinking out of the same aquifer. So it's going to be important to take a close look at what happened there and try to use the best data to make the best decisions.
McGinnis says he's concerned about the impacts to people because housing is within just a few thousand feet of the landfill, which was an open burn dump for 30 years.
You know, the fact that these facilities are in residential areas, people live next to them, that it is really important to monitor, you know, what these folks might be exposed to through soil and air. It's a very, very good thing that they're on a municipal water system, because I wouldn't want to think about, you know, pumping groundwater in that area. But that's a terrible thing to deprive property owner from, is their, you know, their water rights to do that. But
the North Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board regulates discharges to the streams and groundwaters of California. McGinnis describes what is being tested for.
I think they're going to stick to their current list, which is VOCs, SVOCs, volatile organic compounds, semi-volatile organic compounds, and then there's a list of metals and a list of what we call general water quality parameters, which give us information about, you know, where does this water come from and how would we expect it to interact with these contaminants.
And what the results are.
They're 100% typical for a landfill where you have material that was disposed of but that you're not quite sure what it was. It's what you would expect to see.
The potential health impacts would affect both the Rancheria and the most densely built neighborhood in non-tribal Laytonville. McGinnis will address how people in either group can advocate for themselves.
The EPA has a trust responsibility to the tribe that the Cal EPA doesn't have. So the tribe will go to EPA for both funding and if they need help with regulatory oversight. This sounds like they've divided the responsibility, but in reality, it brings more people and often money to the table. So that's one of the benefits of this meeting is hopefully get folks interested in, you know, they can complain to their county supervisor, and they should. The county supervisors representing them should be aware of this and about it, but they really need to go to Cal EPA and to the water board and say, hey, we think we have a problem or we want some action on this, or so we want somebody to come address our concerns beyond telling us there's no problem when we think we have evidence to the contrary.
He says he hopes people will be empowered to take meaningful action for themselves by what they learn.
I really want folks to kind of just kind of come together to learn. And to those that want to see changes out there to help them, educate them enough so that they can direct it at the right folks first and be effective. The conversation we just had is actually pretty important for folks to hear because they often don't think about calling their state senator or their state or other state representatives. But those are the folks that actually could facilitate change in this, or at least get the ball rolling in the right direction. EPA is just going to defer back to Cal EPA. And you give a complaint to them, makes it really easy for them to do their job and notify Cal EPA. When if you went directly, then they would have more responsibility to this.
The broadcast should begin here on KMUD around 5:30 p.m. and last through 7:30 p.m. This is Kelly Lincoln reporting.
The former Willits Mayor Bruce Burton will fill a vacancy on the Willits City Council. KZYX's Elise Cox shares this report.
The Willits City Council on Wednesday appointed Bruce Burton, owner of the Willits Redwood Company, to fill a vacancy left by the resignation of Councilwoman Greta Connie. Burton will serve the remaining 2 years of Connie's term. Before making that appointment, the council interviewed 7 candidates: Robin Leeler, Ragda Zachary, Sherry Ebion, Bruce Burton, Daniel Sampson, Ithaca Moore, and Garrett Moore. Of the 7 candidates, only Robin Leeler and Bruce Burton have previously asked Willits voters for support. Burton, who spent 20 years as a council member, began his last extended term of office in 2008. The sawmill owner was the top vote-getter in that election with 945 votes. In 2012, Burton won re-election with 793 votes. In that election, he trailed Holly Madrigal and Mage Strong, the top vote-getters. In 2016, Burton lost his bid for re-election, receiving just 660 votes. That's 2 more votes than Robin Leeler received in the 2024 election, which she lost to Matthew Alanese. An initial nomination of Burton by Allman and Gonzalez failed, with Mayor Larry Stransky supporting Sherry Ebion and Alanese supporting Robin Leeler. It passed after Stransky said he would support Burton. Here's how the selection process went down. To start, City Attorney James Lance explained that the city chose to fill the office by appointment to avoid the expense and delay of holding a special election. Then City Manager Brian Bender laid out the ground rules.
Basically, from start to finish, once a candidate comes in, introduces themselves, starts a question and answer session with the council, and then it will be opened up to the public. We're trying to limit that to about 20 minutes. So we're trying to be respectful and manage the time effectively.
Next, the council members presented their questions.
I'm going to ask, what do you believe is the most important issues facing Willits, and how would you address them in 2 minutes?
Give or take.
And mine is two, is how do you plan to engage with the involvement of the community in decision-making process?
And I'm going to ask, how do you plan to ensure fiscal responsibility and make the most effective use of city resources?
And I plan on asking, the council has one employee, our city manager. Can you share any experiences you have supervising or managing employees?
Council members also asked the public in attendance if there was anything else they wanted to add. Former Mayor Matt Strong spoke up.
I'd like the candidates to be asked if they have any conflict of interest that would prevent them dealing with most of the city business.
Madge, if that was incorporated in another question, would it be? Would that be okay with you if we? That's a fair question.
Sure.
Yeah, thank you.
The interviews revealed key differences between the top three candidates. In his statement, Burton emphasized his past experience on the council and said his priorities were core services such as clean water, sewer service, a reliable police department, and road maintenance.
I've been a Willits resident for some time, and I've spent some time up there in those chairs. I'm still interested in what goes on in the community. I've obviously had a break for 8 years since I've been on the council. And, things in my personal life have changed somewhat with the passing of Linda. And the last couple of years have been kind of tough. But I feel like I've got still a lot of reasons to be concerned and want to be involved in the decisions of the town. I've got a son that lives here. I've got a business here. I've got grandchildren that are being raised here, and family. And I think that I could help make some decisions that will get more of our kids to come back to town.
Leeler emphasized community engagement, listening, and fostering collaboration, diversity, and inclusivity. During her interview, Leeler said financial matters were her top priority. In her written statement, Leeler said her priorities were bringing the farmers market back to City Park, replacing stunted trees on the north edge of City Park, and expanding mental health and behavioral services in Willits. She also said she wanted to build a hospital on the old Howard Hospital site.
A year ago, when Madge Strong decided not to run for re-election, I began by getting to know city staff and city council members that I expected to be working with. Who could have predicted the many changes we've seen since then? I began walking door to door, and by the fourth night, I could not wait for it to cool off enough to start my evening adventure. 2 hours each evening, talking personally to hundreds of neighbors and friends over the next 8 weeks. I was learning so much every day, and mostly I learned just how much I love this town.
Sherry Ebiam described volunteering her financial expertise.
After 18 years of teaching, I left it and went into school finance and became the chief financial officer of a number of different school districts. I continued to delve into finance in various boards that I'm involved with. I'm on the Measure B board, the Mental Health Treatment Act board. I helped write their financial plan for the first 5 years.
For KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox. For all our local stories with photos and more, visit kzyx.org. You can get the KZYX News podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
In state news, wildfire survivors urge government leaders to keep community needs in mind at LA Wildfire Community Meeting. Teresa Wersbianska reports.
A community-led listening session at Leo Beck Temple in Los Angeles Tuesday urged local leaders to ensure a wildfire recovery that meets people's needs. Donnie Kinsey is an Altadena resident who lost his home in the Eaton Fire.
The Eden fire took everything. Altadena's gone. For those that know and have been there before, it was so beautiful. It was something that you'll never see again. The pocket of Black history there that, you know, I'm really afraid of being erased. It's just something that I hope that everybody, you know, knows about now and helps to preserve.
He and other community members say they need local and state leaders to provide rebuilding resources that take community needs into account. First on the list is for leaders to prevent speculators from preying on vulnerable people displaced by the fires. They say maintaining local ownership of destroyed and damaged properties is critical to community recovery. They also say local businesses need support if landlords can't or won't rebuild. The ripple effect of destruction spans farther than just those immediately impacted by the fires. Ermalinda Guardarama is a house cleaner who worked with her two daughters in the Palisades. She says she hasn't been able to work since the fires started.
So that day we were only able to work one day because the evacuation order came that same day at 7 o'clock.
Fue un susto tremendo para nosotros. Fue demasiada la preocupación, la angustia que tuvimos.
Anguish, and it was terrifying what we went through that day.
A Palisades resident, Wally Marks, who lost his home in the fire, says homeowners need advocates who can ensure homeowners are treated and compensated fairly by insurance companies. The organizers of the event also call for guaranteed income payments for 1 year to those whose lives and livelihoods have been impacted by the fires.
It's the ramifications that I'm really concerned about, the things that have not been revealed, or the employees. I've spoken to my landscaper of 25 years and asked, how are you doing? What are you doing differently? I said, what does support from the government look like to you, Rafi Ochoa? And he said, I don't know what to do. I lost a third of my business. Have you laid people off? Yes. I said, well, I'm going to learn more and I will share it with you. So I'm crushed, but I'm optimistic about my future. I'm optimistic about my immediate community being reimagined, rebuilt.
Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass says the impact of the wildfires will no doubt be far-reaching. She urges community members to continue to support each other as leadership continues to plan for recovery efforts.
The amount of grief and loss on an individual basis through this disaster is so profound. In communities in so many different ways, communities that are far apart from each other, that have history that predates what happened here, even the reasons for being here in Los Angeles. But in the midst of all the grief, people standing together and being willing, number one, to be here while you're trying to put your life back together, but also being willing to share and help others at the same time.
California Governor Gavin Newsom signed several executive orders last week that would aid in recovery efforts, including an order to fast-track temporary housing and protect tenants and homeowners. Bass says to prevent speculators in Los Angeles, Governor Newsom has issued an executive order that bans unsolicited and undervalued offers to purchase property from fire victims in specific zip codes, essentially prohibiting predatory real estate investors from taking advantage of impacted people and making quick cash offers below market value on damaged homes. I'm Teresa Wierzbianska, Pacifica Radio, KPFA.
San Francisco resolution affirms sanctuary city, solidarity with immigrant residents. Max Pringle reports.
District 9 Supervisor Jackie Fielder sponsored the resolution, which all of her colleagues co-sponsored. She told a rally before the supervisors' meeting that the message of the resolution is clear.
We are not going back. We are here with our immigrant neighbors. We will be here whether you are a tech CEO, a tech worker, a student, a janitor, no matter your status, you deserve to feel safe, and that is exactly what Sanctuary is about.
Mayor Daniel Lurie said San Francisco is a city that welcomes its immigrant residents and appreciates what they bring to the city.
We recognize your contributions to our city, and we stand with you. You belong here. I've always said that public safety is my first priority. That means everyone in our city should feel comfortable interacting with local law enforcement and accessing city services.
Police Chief Bill Scott said the city's Sanctuary City policy makes his department's job of protecting the city and its residents easier.
Targeting immigrants who have built families, businesses, and homes here does not improve public safety. It does the exact opposite. It makes people fearful to report crimes or to obtain needed health care or city services. It makes children afraid to go to school, to the library, to the playgrounds, and that is not what we want.
The city's public defender, Manu Raju, is the son of Indian immigrants. He said a third of San Francisco residents are foreign-born, and the city will always oppose forces in the country that seek to demonize immigrants.
For those of you who are the descendant or immigrants yourself, that immigration story is one that takes tremendous, tremendous courage. And we're here to honor those immigrant stories and honor the immigrants that compose San Francisco.
Raju said fear-mongering about immigrants runs counter to the facts that, he says, shows that when immigrants trust the police, they're more willing to speak up about crime and cooperate with the police.
This long-standing law helps victims and witnesses, including survivors of domestic violence, come forward and get the help they need without fear of deportation. Study after study after study, let me be clear, has confirmed that public safety benefits of sanctuary policies. Cities and counties with sanctuary policies have less crime and are more economically prosperous.
The city of San Francisco has also introduced an immigration rapid response hotline to offer legal or other assistance to immigrants who've had run-ins with immigration and customs enforcement. That number is 415-200-1548. That's 415-200-1548. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
In national news, the Trump administration has rescinded its order that froze trillions of dollars in federal grants and loans after a federal judge blocked the directive on Tuesday. However, the administration says it remains committed to reviewing government programs and eliminating funding for what it describes as, quote, woke ideology, close quote. According to the New York Times, the freeze, which was issued Monday night, caused mass confusion among states, nonprofits, schools, and hospitals, many of which were uncertain if they had suddenly lost federal funding. The directive was intended to implement President Trump's executive orders that call for a review of government spending and the removal of funding from programs deemed inconsistent with these policies. Though the White House walked back the freeze, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt stated that the executive orders behind it, quote, remain in full force and effect, close quote, and will be rigorously enforced. The Office of Management and Budget, OMB, confirmed that agencies will no longer be required to halt payments while reviewing program eligibility. The freeze had already caused disruptions with several states, including Arizona, Washington, Colorado, Rhode Island, and New Jersey, reporting that they were temporarily locked out of federal grant payment systems. In Washington state alone, up to 32% of the state's budget was at risk, affecting programs such as school lunches, child care, substance abuse treatment, and highway maintenance. Democratic lawmakers, including Senator Patty Murray of Washington, called the White House's reversal an, quote, important victory for the American people, close quote, and accused the administration of sowing chaos through incompetence and disregard for the law. Nonprofits that rely on federal grants also breathed a sigh of relief. Diane Yentl, the CEO of the National Council of Nonprofits, stated that organizations providing services such as disaster relief, housing assistance, rape crisis support, and suicide hotlines can now continue their essential work, at least for now. While the immediate freeze has been lifted, the Trump administration is expected to continue exploring ways to reshape federal funding in line with its priorities. KMUD News will continue to share updates. Additional information, including our previous reporting, can be found at kmud.org. That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Lisa Music, Elise Cox, Teresa Wersbianska, and Max Pringle. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.